Well, hello, everybody. Today I'd like to welcome Dr. Stephanie McCurry to the show. Stephanie is a professor of history at Columbia University and specializes in the American Civil War and Reconstruction, the 19th century United States, the American South, and the history of women and gender. She is the author of three books, including Confederate Reckoning, Power and Politics in the Civil War South, and most recently, Women's War, Fighting and Surviving the American Civil War. She is currently writing a book on Reconstruction. Stephanie was born in Belfast, Northern Ireland. She has two children and lives in New York City. You can follow her on Twitter at smccurry3 and see her work and events at stephaniemccurry.com. All right, with all that, let's welcome Stephanie to the show. Stephanie, thank you so much for being on the show. I really appreciate it.
It's my pleasure, Keith. So happy to be here.
And you know what? This occurred to me a couple of weeks ago, but as I was scheduling podcast interviews for this month, this is the 100th episode of this podcast.
Awesome.
How about that, right? It's a day of celebration. I think that's kind of cool. I mean, I just started this thing, you know, sort of a hobby, and then it turned into something a little bit bigger than that. And now, you know, it's here we are at the 100th episode.
Lucky us.
So if I was network television, we'd have a cake and, you know, and a party and stuff. But maybe I'll do that. Maybe I'll do that later. But anyway, you are the author of a really wonderful book called Confederate Reckoning. The book came out in 2010. And the listeners of this show will understand, and they will know that I find myself returning to this book over and over as when I'm interviewing other guests and when I'm speaking in my classrooms. This book seems to come up all the time, and it's a book that deals with political culture in the Confederacy, and I want to get to that. But before I do, I was wondering what it is that compelled you to write about power and politics in the Confederate States of America.
Well, thank you, Keith. And it is interesting to be talking about this book now in 2020, since I published it in 2010 and was writing it all through the late 90s and 2000s. I had little kids and I was raising little kids. I was living in California. I was doing archival work. It was a very extended process. So the things that compelled me to write it when I started were a little different, although not unrelated, more academic. Two things I would say. One was that I published my first book, I think, in 1995. And I was moving forward into, it was on the antebellum period and secession and all of this. And I was really struck by the dynamism of Civil War history in the early 90s. And yet, very little of it was about the South. The South, the Confederacy part, was still stuck in this same old debate about why the South lost the Civil War. And it was kind of a standoff between social historians or cultural historians and military historians, which, given the way the question was framed, the military historians were always going to win. Because why the South lost the Civil War is implicitly a military question. And yet, Civil War history was absolutely transformed by the emphasis on it as an African-American story and a story of emancipation and a story of history from the bottom up, you know, how the war for the Union became a war for emancipation. So I was sort of saying to myself, well, what's going on with the Confederacy? I mean, this is the place where slavery was entrenched. This is why the war started. There is some epic drama here that goes on during the war that leads to defeat, but the only thing people care about with the Confederacy is why they seceded and why they got defeated. They're not at all interested in, or we haven't made people be interested in, the experience of this interlude of American history that was a separate nation state, the Confederacy. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to write about that, and I wanted to see what happened if you brought the new methods of historical analysis, you know, women as actors, African enslaved people, and so that's the first thing. And then the related thing is that one of the really important things for me all through my life in becoming a historian and any of the history I do is what brought me to it was a sense that we had to write a richer history with different actors, like the life we live in, the way we see the complexity of who makes change in our own world and the flatness with how we write about the past, particularly in political history. Political history is so easily the big questions are political history questions. You know, why did we have a civil war? But the approaches often narrow so quickly to electoral politics and party politics, which leaves out, in the case of the South and the slave South, you know, I don't know, 2/3 of the population. So do we really believe that those people weren't making history? Well, I don't. So in that sense, that those were the two reasons that I wrote it. And I wanted to see what happens when you talk about who are the people and who are the people who make history. And so in that sense, it was a effort or part of my mission was to show who matters in history, that the set of actors. I'm just really frustrated all the time with reading about, I mean, people, it's 2020 and people still write history with no women in it, for example. Mm-hmm. And because enslaved people didn't have a vote, they had nothing to do with the experience of the Confederacy. It's the dynamic of it. It's ridiculous. So there was those were the sort of double reasons. Mm-hmm. And they're a little different than now, yeah.
I mean, I'm glad you took up the effort. Honestly, this is one of the biggest concerns in my classes. And of course, you know, everybody knows I teach at a private high school in Los Angeles, and these are my advanced classes on the Civil War and on American historiography. We bring these things up pretty frequently. And one of the things that we get into all the time is the cause and the course and the defeat of the Confederate nation. And, you know, what's going on behind the lines, what's happening in terms of internal disruption and conflict and various things like that, and how much of that really frames the political course of the nation is something that comes up frequently, which is why I'm constantly returning to your book, right? But let's start with a question about the Confederate nation. Framing the Confederacy as a nation can get you into hot water sometimes, because then people will, you know, if you think about it that way, sometimes people assume that you're giving some sort of legitimacy to the Confederacy. And I want to kind of put that aside, because that's not my mission. My mission is to look at it from many of the Confederate leadership's eyes, that they thought there was a nation. So let's take them at their word and say, let's a Confederate nation. Now, leadership claimed that they were the true inheritors of the founding generation. And it was the Republican Party in the North that had steered the country off course. And they wrote a constitution, the Confederates did, that in many ways mirrored the U.S. document that went into effect in 1789. But they mirrored it only in some ways, not in all ways. And that always strikes me as particularly interesting. Can you explain the differences between the Confederate Constitution and the United States Constitution, the differences that most clearly distinguished the Confederacy as a nation?
Yeah. No, this is a great question, because to this day, many, many people believe that the Confederate Constitution is a replica of the original. And you're right, structurally, it follows the same form, and it borrows a lot of stuff, but it makes really important, it has very important changes. And I think that's where you, like, okay, so if they were perfectly happy with the original Constitution, then, and they thought it was pro-slavery enough, then they would have copied it. They didn't. It wasn't pro-slavery enough for them. And you're right that they blame the Republican Party, but to the leaders of the Confederacy and Southern politicians, the Republican Party was the final straw. The country had their reservations about it from the beginning. They had fought all along to maintain control of how the Constitution was written and interpreted, and in the courts, etc. And they'd had these built-in protections for a really long time, including the supermajority they got from the two-thirds clause. And when this started to give way in the face of immigration, democratic democratization, and they lost their electoral advantage, there was a group who wanted out. They wanted to try again. And they wrote a constitution, which is, I think we ought to understand as resolving from their point of view, all the blockages and dilemmas and fights over the antebellum period over the constitution. So they did a number of things. They put the nation explicitly under God. They wrote that into the constitution. They insisted that it was, as they had always insisted the US was, a confederation of sovereign states. That had been litigated, right, through since 1789. Was it different than the Articles of Confederation? They said no. We never gave up our sovereignty when we joined the United States. They made that explicit. That's huge. It's also worth noting that they didn't give those states the right to secede. That was the one thing they fought about all along, that they didn't, because no state writes its own demise into its founding document. So they didn't do that. But if you look at the very beginning, it's under God, they're sovereign states. And then there were other key changes in various parts. I wrote an article for the New York Times annotating the Confederate Constitution. It's a great teaching document because it highlights the parts that they changes and explains what they changed. So the other things they did was, well, they did some things that were just conservative, like they wanted a single term executive. So I think it was 6 or 7 years, I forget.
Yeah, 6 years.
So they did that. And then they also changed, they put in a, most importantly, they took out all the euphemisms for slavery, no other persons held to servitude or labor. It was wallpaper, slaves, slavery, slave. They're not embarrassed. They're explicit. They put that in there. And they put in explicit constitutional defenses of the right to hold property in slaves. They resolve the question of whether a person can legitimately carry their property into another state or territory and retain the property claim. That's explicit. So they're expecting to be an empire and they're providing for that possibility. They're also resolving any question, if any state joined the Confederacy that didn't have slavery, any person who took their slaves into that state would retain that right. And then the thing I think they did that was the most naked was they were forming a central government, a federal government, and they explicitly withheld or denied the right of that federal government to ever interfere with the legitimacy of slavery. So this became a problem during and especially towards the end of the war when the Davis administration in cahoots with Lee wanted to enlist black soldiers but had no ability to free them and had to go hat in hand to the states to ask the states to free them, which they refused to do. So they denied themselves a power that they actually in the end wanted, but which they could never have imagined they would want when they started. So in many ways, that was the arc of Confederate reckoning was this is the pro-slavery world they think they're building into perpetuity. It's terrifying for enslaved people. And then what happens to it? What happens to that? How able are they to make that vision of the nation a reality? And the first reality check is that they have done everything they can to limit democratic representation. There were debates about whether they could return to only a propertied franchise, and they couldn't do that because of poor whites and the practices of the antebellum, you know, the customs of the country, so to speak. They had basically empowered only a small proportion of their population, that is to say white men over the age of 21. And this turned out to be not enough of a popular voice and popular support. And they had, just to repeat the essential point, they had deprived themselves of a power that they would end up needing.
It seems to me that in some ways, and I spoke to Ann Tucker about this a couple of weeks ago in her new book about Confederate nationalism, but it seems to me that they're in essence kind of perfecting, from their point of view anyway, perfecting something that was flawed. By securing slavery. I mean, the U.S. Constitution guarantees price and property, but not specifically slave property. And so that pretty much closes the deal on that story. But let's talk about this. I mean, you brought up state autonomy, a confederation of autonomous states, and something that they were very, very keen on, and something that really framed a lot of the rhetoric around the secession debates of 1860 and 1861, the states' rights rhetoric. And that's, I think that's how they sold it, you know, to a lot of people. But as you point out in this book, they became really a profoundly centralized nation, more so than the Lincoln administration in many ways. And they have a draft very early on in the war. They utilize impressment in terms of, you know, impressing slaves, impressing crops to feed the armies, and they do this right away. How is it If they're going after private property and they're centralizing the government and doing these things, how does Confederate leadership reconcile this nod to state rights with the reality of the Confederate experience, once the war is underway?
Well, I mean, this was one of the main things that I was trying to track, and the sort of dramatic arc of the story of the Confederacy, especially in terms of what it means for people who are living through this, ordinary yeoman farmers and poor whites and all the enslaved people on plantations and farms. So first of all, I think we have to remember that when Southern political leaders in the antebellum period said that they were profoundly states' rights, they also expected, there was something disingenuous about that, because they wanted a states' rights structure, but they also wanted disproportionate power in the federal state. So they had the presidency for many, many of those years. They had the Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, or the military. I mean, Jefferson Davis was what? Secretary of State, war. Of War, 4 years before secession, something like that. Mm-hmm. And so Southerners always spoke out of both sides of their mouth. They wanted states' rights so that nobody could interfere with their right to control matters of domestic social order. But that was premised on their ability to control the central state and its foreign policy, especially. Matt Karp and other people have written about this. So in some ways, what they did in the Confederacy was the same, except they had a states' rights philosophy, but the realities of governing, especially once war started, meant that they had to use the powers of the central government to defend this nation at war. And you mentioned impressment of slaves, of crops. See, the thing is, initially you don't have to, there's no contradiction there. Impressment initially was voluntary. Mm-hmm. Then there was non-compliance. This is one of the things that fascinated me the most. Planters, to the extent that they, as a class, slaveholders, were the chief support for the Confederacy, they were great until it cost them anything. They were really shitty nationalists in the end if they had to sacrifice anything for the nation. They believed that the army and the government was there to protect their property from the war, and here comes the government asking for their property for the war, and they're not enough of them are complying. So the voluntary thing collapses pretty quickly, and by this October of the second year, impressment and conscription, so white male conscription, is mandatory, and that's because the scale of the war suddenly moves into another dimension. And Davis is reviled, okay? He doesn't win any friends for this. This is amazing to me how Lee ducks it, because I guess he's just on the military side. Davis is the one who takes the hit for all of this. And there's nothing very admirable about Jefferson Davis. I mean, I've read many, many, many volumes of his papers. But the one thing I think people don't appreciate about Jefferson Davis is, reluctant as he was, and petty and petulant as he was, he eventually did what he felt had to be done to get the military resources to fight that war. The problem was it had to come from the population, from the constituency. This is true in all wars. This is what nationalism means. And, war was foreseeable. They weren't prepared for it. And as Bensel wrote years ago, if you don't have a modern industrial private sector, where are you going to get the materiel of war? How are you going to tax your population if you don't have that? Like, you can't put out a contract for uniforms in... or for armaments, or for ships in the South, and a private, the only one was Tredegar. I mean, they're just, and then as you probably know, Birmingham and places like that grew up, and Atlanta grew up to meet this need. But that, all those capacities did not exist in the private sector. So essentially, it was a model of centralization and top down kind of industrialization in the context of military need.
They went into this war with a great deal of confidence. Surely they knew that, they were going to have to draw from the population at some point. Is this as simply as a matter of the war went on longer than they had anticipated, and so they have to turn to the population in ways that they maybe didn't feel comfortable with? And at the same time, is the sort of pushback against this a rejection of Confederate nationalism, or is it just people getting annoyed because their things are being taken away from them when they still may support the bid for independence?
Well, first of all, I think it's ideological in a way that we really have to understand. And this completely fascinated me. It was one of the most interesting things, is trying to get understand the mentality of people going into this war, especially the political elite, is I think they had become so accustomed to a mechanistic view of, especially of enslaved people, that they were non-parties to any decision. So none of their, it's actually absolutely fascinating to read the debates over secession and see that the only people who are warning that slaves are gonna be a problem are unionists. So like West Virginia unionists are saying, this is gonna be a bloodbath and you're gonna have to answer to the enslaved. And most of the political elite not only denied that, they couldn't compute that in any way. So this is pro-slavery belief that goes so deep, you can't compute. Mm-hmm. And this is my read. Mm-hmm. And so that's a big part of it. So part of it is the escalation of the war and the scale of resources needed to fight it, including manpower, the turn to conscription. Mm-hmm. But it's also this ideological blind spot or worldview, really, that made them unable to comprehend how human beings might oppose this this national agenda and thwart it. And the second question you ask about whether, say, white people who, planters, yeomen, poor whites, urban whites, people who end up becoming a problem for the Confederate government, is it out of ideological conviction or political conviction, or is it just out of war exhaustion or anything else? there is political opposition from the beginning, and it doesn't necessarily decrease. In some parts of the Confederacy, as you know, it doesn't decrease. Those unionists turn into union military units in places like Alabama and Northwest Georgia and places like that. So that's for sure. There are some people who didn't, white people, men especially, who didn't support secession, who take up the fight out of necessity once they're invaded. So there's that. But I think a lot of the opposition, there is opposition to the Confederacy that becomes political and ideological, for sure. And a lot of that comes from the planter elite. Like if you are, and the political elite, if you look at Joe Brown in Georgia or Vance, and I mean, Vance is a different matter. He kind of tries to stay in support of the Davis administration. Joe Brown is just an obstructionist. I mean, he puts hundreds of people, thousands of people on the civil employment, the civil government officer roles so that they can't be conscripted. In North Carolina, the courts fight it to the bitter end. So there are people, obviously, who join the Confederacy for this states' rights philosophy, for it to finally be perfected, that kind of union. And then they find they're living in one that is far more centralized and extractive than even the union. And the backlash towards that is you know, very widespread and deep. And it's also varied. Like, when the move comes to think about enlisting black soldiers, it comes from the southwestern states on the other side of the Mississippi River that have been decimated by Grant's and Sherman's advance. So then people start to think more like, you know, get rid of half of slavery to save a bit, or it's already gone, so we might as well save our independence. But there's not much of that in the East. So there's an East-West split. There's an Appalachian class split. Mm-hmm. And there is some openly anti-Confederate political organizing, especially in places like North Carolina, right? I mean, there's peace parties and other kinds of things, as well as just people fed up and pissed off and also starving. Like, you know.
Yeah, there's always that.
There's always that. But I mean, there's no experience, I think, in the archives, like reading the papers of a longstanding, incredibly entitled planter who wakes up one morning to find out that half of his slaves have run away the night before. And that they did it by signaling a Union gunboat to come and pick them up. Like, it's planned. And watching the meltdown, the psychological meltdown, which is on paper, list of those who betrayed me. list of those who didn't. Like, come on, there's nothing better in life than opening a folder in an archive and seeing John Berkeley Grimble or Manigo sit there and try to figure out who screwed them first.
I always think that's, I think that's really interesting. You know, I remember, I think even some of Jefferson Davis's slaves ran off and he was confused. Why on earth? I know the Bend Plantations, they fancied themselves, him and his brother Joe fancied themselves as enlightened slaveholders and were just confused when you know, the slaves, you know, burned their houses down.
Well, Joseph's letters to Jefferson, those are a hoot. I mean, Joseph's running the plantations and he's writing to president trying to tell him that, you know, everything you stand for has just been repudiated by these people here. Mm-hmm. It's worth the price of admission for sure.
And you see it coming from, you know, the rank and file as well. I've read letters from the Petersburg trenches, especially after the Battle of the Crater, and they were surprised that their former slaves had joined the Union Army and were attacking them with physical violence. They didn't understand why they would do something like that when, you know, when they had provided for them their entire lives, and here they are doing everything they can.
Well, I think if there's any connection to the current moment, it's that we need to understand people are now, I see it all over social media, they're trying to figure out how can white Christians support this kind of murderous militia activity like we saw last week. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the first things I wrote about in my career in the early 90s was about pro-slavery ideology. And I think we do not understand, most people do not spend enough, especially Civil War historians, they start too close to the war. They don't know enough about, they don't know as much as it would be helpful to know, I should say, about who these people were and what shaped their worldview. Mm-hmm. And, you know, more than half of pro-slavery tracts in the United States were written by evangelical ministers.
Yeah.
Okay? And so white supremacy is not something that you learn in a minute and discard in a minute. I'm writing a book on Reconstruction now, and part of what I'm trying to cope with is that. Like, the 13th Amendment can't destroy slavery. People have to destroy slavery. They have to choose to accept new sets of social arrangements, and many, many people not only do not, but cannot. The habit of command and of ignoring the needs of wide swaths of people who are dependent on them is so ingrained that they think they know they're human beings, but they act, they're human beings that are to them property, mm-hmm. Who are there to serve their needs. So I think that, the whiteness is something I probably didn't, I don't use that word a lot. I'm not sure I'd use it at all in Confederate Reckoning. I probably would use it more now, but I still think it's a word that has to be deconstructed. Like you have to explain what it is, and what it is a set of ideological commitments that come through things that people learn as children and don't question, like what a family is, what a Christian family is. And, you know, pro-slavery would have been much less effective if it had been relayed through political propaganda. It was relayed through religion. Mm-hmm. And it is disseminated in the most, not only public way, but take it into yourself way. Organize your sense of morality around it. So that's really hard. And that's what we're seeing in the war.
And I think this is one of the things that my students grapple with a lot as well. This idea that it's so ingrained in a culture, in a worldview, that it would have made no sense. It wouldn't have computed to people to, you know, distance themselves from this. But let's talk about these social arrangements, because I think this is, you know, there's a very important part of your book, you know, talking about the politically dispossessed in this book. And of course, we speak here about white yeoman women, especially, and enslaved people, both men and women. And you argue that the Confederates' bid for independence is an effort to make these social arrangements permanent. And I think, and this struck me as very interesting, because these days you see a lot of folks talking about the United States in similar ways, suggesting that this is, you know, this political rights, traditional political rights, as we understand, and the vote, you know, those sorts of things, it's limited to white men throughout the country, not just in the southern states. So what is it about the Confederacy that is different here? And how do we separate that from the trends that are going on everywhere?
You mean at that time?
At that time. Yeah. Huh?
Well, Yeah, I think I failed actually to make this case as clearly as I needed to, because I've been asked about this a lot. Mm-hmm. So, okay, obviously, in 1860, say, or 1861, there were very few places left in the United States where black men had the right to vote. I think it was like four places, I forget. but very few. And obviously, women of any race, white or otherwise, had no right to vote, although that was contested. It was on the agenda, not nearly as much as black men's right to vote, or birthright citizenship, or those kinds of things. So this is for sure. So in many ways, people would say, well, the Confederacy was no different than the Union. The thing is that if you exclude black men's right to vote in the North, you're excluding a tiny percentage of the population. And in the South, if you exclude it, you're excluding 40% of the population. So if they're both democracies, they're very different kind of democracies. And I think it's quite clear that Southerners, white Southerners, and Confederates especially, they didn't think of themselves as democracy. They thought of themselves as a republic, with a republican form of government in which the right to vote was a privilege, and a privilege which was conferred and distinction on a certain group of people because they had the ability to make decisions for the dependent population in their household. And that included enslaved people and women and children. Now, okay, in the North, maybe in the abstract, it doesn't look like that different, but in practice, what that meant is all the working class in the South is disfranchised, all the laboring class, or most of it, right? All enslaved people who were working for other people. In the North, there is an expansion of democracy over the period of the antebellum period. And it's precisely like Irish immigrants, German immigrants. I mean, it's not uncontroversial. There are nativists who don't want that, but they're not winning, or they weren't winning. Actually, by the 1850s, right, it's even the North is starting to retrench from the expansion and the promise of the franchise. But it's a very different argument in the North. So in choosing to secede, part of what the Southern political elite is saying is, we want out of that fight. We're going to lose that fight over time. Black men are going to get the vote. Immigrants are going to get the vote. Propertyless people are going to get the vote. Wage workers are going to get the vote. Women are going to get the vote. We're losing that fight now, and we want out. And the irony is that they wanted to opt out of a very dangerous political culture, and they put themselves in an even, I mean, nobody was talking about whole scale, uncompensated, immediate emancipation in 1860. Nobody, Frederick Douglass, nobody could have imagined that in 4 years, emancipation would have been accomplished, uncompensated and immediate. Mm-hmm. It was only the war that made that possible. And they created, the Southern white Southerner elite created that context and that possibility. So they seceded to perfect a white man's republic. And they ended up destroying it.
One of the greatest ironies in a conflict that shot through with irony left and right. This is, I think, that is the greatest one. And some people warned against that. Sam Houston, for example, of Texas, warned the secessionists that what you're doing here to protect the institution may very well destroy the institution. And so many Unionists felt that slavery was best protected under the United States Constitution, and I suppose that it was,
which certainly wouldn't have ended by 1865.
Absolutely not. That's something that my students are always, they're always taken aback when I say that. And I go, I'm surprised that this ended at all, because if you'd have told somebody in the summer of 1860 that, hey, by 1865, this is all going to be a done deal, I think people would have put you in an asylum because it would have been so unlikely.
And Lincoln, when he was trying to cut deals in the middle of the war, was offering like horizons of 1900 for gradual emancipation. So it's not just Southerners. Yeah, they gambled and they lost. That's my favorite part of the whole thing. They were high risk gamblers and they lost.
They did indeed. Okay, so the people that we're discussing now, women, enslaved people, they don't have access to traditional political power, as that's safe to say. But they do exercise political power nonetheless. And this is what I think is the most most important part of your book. Now, how is it that they do this? And the Confederate government has to deal with this. This is what I find so interesting. They have to deal with the exercising of political power from those who are, you know, not included in traditional voting and the body politic. How is it? What is it that they do, women and enslaved people? And how is it that the Confederate government responds?
Well, I think this is the dangers of war, is that you can't wage them you can't wage them in the modern period without the support of the population, mm-hmm. or at least enough of the population that you can get the resources to fight war. And what happens in the Confederacy is they've written this constitution, which really basically empowers, okay, so if you have a population of what, I didn't check the numbers again, but something like 9 million, mm-hmm. and 3.5 million of them are enslaved. Mm-hmm. And so that leaves, you know what, that leaves 5.5 million, and half of those are women. So that leaves, you know, 2.5 million, then you've got men under 21. So basically the conscription Bureau and the Confederacy estimated that there was about 800,000 enlistable men. So I'll start with this with slaves, because that's where that thought is going. So, you know, if you do the math, you can figure out that you've got a problem. I mean, how are you going to face the population of the Union, 22 million people, all adult male men available for military service at a certain point? Not so in the Confederacy. So I mean, basically what I was trying to argue was, to go back to the more organized thought is, you need the support of the population to wage war. But nobody thinks, and no secessionists think that that population includes women or slaves. They're counted out. They're not part of the political project at all. But as it turns out, if they don't support the war, or if they obstruct it, that actually matters. Mm-hmm. And so they do. Now, I do not ever say, nor do I want to be read as saying, that all these women rise in opposition to the Confederacy. What they rise in opposition to is the evisceration of their households and their way of life. And this is the political leverage that they have, is that when their men are conscripted, all these local units that are forming, they promise, and governors and Davis and everybody else, they promise that these women will be protected. And what poor white and yeoman women mean by protection is not protection from slaves, because there's none of them around them. They mean protection from dependence and protection is to provide subsistence. Mm-hmm. So this is an agrarian society. This is a farming society. These people do not have slave labor. They've always worked on the labor of adult men and women and children. And so the men are gone, and they're gone in disproportionate amounts compared to planter men. So politically, there's this sense of grievance, and these white women I've read a lot of political, basically the way I began to understand what the hell was going on was I just read governor's papers. And I had used governor's papers before for my earlier antebellum work, and women only write governors for one main reason. Their husbands have been condemned to death and they're trying to get them a pardon. Mm-hmm. That's the only, they're pardon letters. By 1860, that's what you've got. By 1861, there's a trickle of letters from white women to governors saying, we're in trouble in this county. We're starving. We're starving here. We're in trouble. I need you to make an individual concession to me. By 1862, the number of letters has increased immensely and the complaints are starting to become more structural. You have taken off our men. Take more of the big men and leave our men here. We're starving here. And by 1863, the State Department, not just the governors, but the State Department, the Secretary of War letters are filled with women writing in collective identities. We soldiers' wives of such and such county want you to know that there's not enough men here to grow food and we are starving. And what are you going to do for us? You said you would protect us, blah, blah, blah. And then lists of names. And X's, they're illiterate. So this is what really the wheels started to turn. This is a political constituency that is mobilizing as we soldiers' wives. And they're doing it, the leverage they have is the promises that have been made to them. So they are making themselves a constituency that politicians have to start to address even before the food riots. And they start to take down these politicians. They denounce county officers who are not providing poor relief in the way they're supposed to, et cetera. And they also end up driving an expansion of welfare provision that nobody anticipated. So in that sense, this is what else is politics? The formation of a self-identified political group, an identifiable a constituency that the representative has to address and answer to, that they can hold accountable or have removed. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was trying to be very careful because having done so much work in my life on Southern history and Southern women, you know, there's nothing women's rights-ish about this. They're not saying, you know, we're citizens and we have a right. They're not saying that at all. They're saying we're soldiers' wives and you owe us because you said you would protect us. So I think that, and people even interviewing me after that book was written and in book reviews, they want to slot it into the history of women's rights. Mm-hmm. Which I don't think it belongs in, because I think we need to understand how difficult women's rights actually is. And that's just too easy, like 1 + 1 + 1 equals the 19th Amendment. Mm-hmm. No. So there's that. So I think that's how, you know, so they're part of the people, but they're the part of the people who are supposed to be passive under normal circumstances, and now they're not. And so that's sort of the way it worked. That's how I think it worked with white women, how they became a constituency that had to be answered to. And the food riots in the bread riots in the spring of 1863 were the tip of the iceberg, but the one that really caught the nation and the United States, really riveted attention on this population that had been destroyed by the war. I mean, there were these super poignant letters where these women would say, there was a time when we could call our little children to our table and have a plenty, and now we are beggars and starvers and we have nothing. Mm. So it's the destruction of yeoman independence by the Confederate government, by the war, by conscription, by the preference to have the 20 Negro exemption. Mm. Rich man's war, poor man's fight. It's not just a poor man's fight, it's a poor women's fight as well. Mm-hmm. And many, many historians had used these letters before, Paul Escott and lots of people, but they had never, ever grappled with the fact that so many of them were from women. And what did that mean for the history of the Confederacy?
And Black people, the enslaved people in the South, in the beginning of the war, and really through much of it, I think that the Confederate leadership saw slavery as a great advantage because it frees up so many of the white citizenry to fight. I believe, and the numbers are rough, but I believe that the Confederacy mobilized upwards of 80% of its military age population into arms, which is a remarkable achievement. But they could only do that because they had labor behind the lines. But of course, that doesn't work out probably as well as they had hoped when thousands of slaves, when given the opportunity, will escape to Union lines, or when slaves realize that something's not quite right and begin to slow down work and do other things, other forms of resistance behind the lines. How is it that the enslaved people wind up shaping Confederate policy also?
Well, I mean, this is one of the ideological claims or boasts of the Confederacy, mm-hmm. to start with, slavery as an element of strength. And by 1860, late 1863, Patrick Claiborne and other officers in the West are saying slavery is the weakest element of our entire system. And so you can chart that. It's like making a map. How did this happen? Well, this recognition is forced on military people first and political leaders second. And part of the reason I wanted to write the book to start with is that I was really unhappy with, well, I shouldn't put it that way. I was really dissatisfied with the new sort of boiled down version of the history of Civil War and emancipation, which was Black people were emancipated because Black men fought, right? This sort of heroic narrative of they earned emancipation by their military service. Now, I'm not trying to say that that's not part of the story, but of what, 170,000 or 180,000 Black men fought in the various armed services. And these are people who are either in the North or who have escaped to the North. Mm-hmm. Now, A, that's a gendered narrative, which needs to be attended to, which I have written about recently, as have other people. So are we saying that Black women do nothing? They just sit in their armchair and wait for emancipation to be delivered? Absolutely not. So that's wrong. And number two, most enslaved people are in the South, and they're in the Confederacy, and they remain in the Confederacy until the bitter end. So the war that they have to fight before they can make it to Union lines, they're already fighting a war against slavery on their plantations, on their farms, in their region, and against the Confederacy. And I knew this because I had read Planter papers. And planters immediately, they get very worried as secession's gearing up. And the minute Lincoln is elected, people like Madigo are writing in Lowcountry, South Carolina, in the Georgia line. He's writing in his diary that the people, which is what he calls his slaves, think they're going to be liberated when Lincoln comes in. Mm-hmm. So he's picking this up among the people in his quarters, the enslaved people, and he's already starting this surveillance operation that goes on for the whole war. So this is part of the war for emancipation. This is a big part of it, is how do you deal with your own? So they're informing inside the Confederacy. We know that Union military tactics include posting soldiers, Union soldiers report that the Confederates are placing their patrols in really weird places. Mm-hmm. Why? Because they're trying to keep slaves in, not just Union soldiers out. And so there's this depletion of military energy and capacity to discipline slaves. This is a huge part of the military history of the Confederacy. And why? Because everybody knows that they do not have the support of, they never thought it mattered whether they have the support, but it certainly matters that they're opposed to them. They're the enemy within. And this is how they come to count. They're recognized as the enemy within. And part of what I try to be clear about in Confederate Reckoning is that the first people to recognize this are their owners. And then it works out to local military commanders. Do you know that, you must know this, there's military orders that go down that people have to destroy their boats so that slaves won't use them to escape, because now it's a military calculation. If they make it across the bay in Pensacola, or across the, I'm writing about Robert Smalls right now, if they manage to make it across to that Union fort, this is a political law. This is a military price that we will pay. So I think what happens is they start with slavery as an element of strength, and they end up being forced to recognize that slaves are the enemy within. And I think this is part of what we need to contend with even after the war, is this sense of vengeance against Black soldiers and Black families for being the traitors. Mm-hmm. This, we think too much in an exceptionalist American history framework, but there's always retaliation against so-called traitors after wars. And I think this is part of what happens here, that they're part of the domestic population, they're entirely affiliated with the enemy. They're actively advancing the interests of the enemy and destroying the interests of their local governments, whether it's the plantation owner or the state. And they become a powerful force in weakening the Confederacy as a military. I mean, part of what I'm trying to argue in Confederate Reckoning is that the Confederacy has to be assessed as a political project and not just a military one, and understood as a political failure and not just a military defeat. And enslaved people play a huge role in both of those things, political failure and military defeat. I mean, what kind of case could the Confederacy have made to keep slaves loyal? Like, ask your students that. Because they end up trying to do that. This is what Claiborne tries to do. Davis says we have to free them. That's why they come to consider enlisting slaves. But that's a mind-boggling question. Like, how... Claiborne says we have to earn their loyalty. Oh my God! Like, okay, so the Confederate project's finished basically by that point, is my point of view.
Mm-hmm. And I would agree with you.
Slaves destroyed it.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with you there, and a number of people did say that very thing. It's like, if we enlist slavery, if we enlist slaves and soldiers in our cause, then what's the point of doing this in the first place? You're throwing our entire ideological premise out the window. And, you know, Robert Toombs of Georgia said this, a number of other people said this, and of course they debated it, which I find interesting is that they debated it at all. I know Lee was in favor of this, but Lee is a man who needs bodies to fill uniforms.
Yeah, and he's belatedly in favor of it.
Yeah, right. This comes along much
later. Late.
And I think that, and it was only the last month or so that I think they ever actually, and they never see combat. Of course, you've got these delusional neo-Confederates out there these days that are saying that there were divisions of black soldiers running around. I'd love to see the pension rolls for that, because I haven't. But I'm, you know. Yeah, but
it's one of those myths that won't die.
It just won't. And the internet's helped that along. Kevin Levin's book on that, I think, on Searching for Black Confederates, is really, really excellent, debunking that myth. But let's talk about this. I mean, and you've mentioned this now a couple of times, this idea that the Confederate defeat is not just a military defeat. And I want to bring this up because this is something that my students ask a lot. And this is something that I think is in contention among Civil War historians now. And I just want to bring up a famous quote that's attributed to George Pickett. After years after Gettysburg, and this might be an apocryphal quote, but it doesn't matter because we think he said it, and I think that that's good enough. And the point hits home anyway. He goes, years after Gettysburg, somebody asked him, General Pickett, how do you explain Confederate defeat at the Battle of Gettysburg? And he responded, I think the Union Army had something to do with it. Which I think is pretty funny, you know. For those out there who would say, Dr. McCurry, you're making way too much of the internal issues with the Confederacy. The Confederates were defeated on the battlefield. It's very clear that that's the case. And many Civil War historians make this argument. How would you respond to that?
Oh, I think it has to. I don't disagree with that. That's the thing. I don't disagree with that. Yes, of course they were defeated on the battlefield. Mm-hmm. My question is how we calculate what happens to get to the battlefield. Is that military history isn't just what happens, or shouldn't be just what happens when soldiers are lined up against each other in a particular engagement, or even the strategic or larger strategic approaches of one side or another. All of that matters, of course, but I think mobilization in a modern period and in societies that call themselves, you know, that build the support on the people, then the question of, you know, as what was his name who said in the North it was a huge issue too. How does a democratic society wage a long war? Mm-hmm. And when he wrote, I don't remember his name now, but when he wrote about it, it was a Union League pamphlet, really widely distributed. And what example did he look to historically to figure out the answer? It was the Napoleonic Wars of invasion and resistance over, which required enormous resources that went well beyond the set piece battle battlefield conflict to guerrilla war, to urban fighting, to the mobilization. Like, how did the Spanish resist the French? It wasn't their army. I mean, they were going to get killed on the official battlefield. So what kind of a war is this? I mean, this is a civil war. And the logic of violence is different. It's not just out there, it's in there. This isn't, you know, even the I think the military, the most useful military thing to think through, which military theorists also thought through, was the Napoleonic Wars. You have a part of it going on in this formal sense, governed by the rules of war, allegedly, out there on these battlefields, which we can study and we can name, but there's another war going on around it, and it's a military struggle too. Partisan forces, guerrilla forces, all of this. But it's also about, like, for example, what would a military historian who takes the view you said say about the fact that the Confederacy is a slave society and its military capacity, its manpower capacity, the single most fundamental delimit on its manpower is the fact that they cannot enlist 40% of the adult male population. Is that a relevant military consideration or not? To me, it is, and not enough has been made of it. And then when those people become not just a neutral or a negative in the sense of omission, that you can't claim them, but they come to count for the other side. And also, as I have recently written, nobody cares about this, but I do. Women are not indifferent to the outcome of these military conflicts. Mm-hmm. They have very strong feelings about them. They play roles in all of them, as some cross-dressing women, of course, and the numbers, they're modest and rising. That's not what interests me the most. What interests me the most is women who engage in these struggles as women and come to matter militarily. Francis Lieber ends up writing the General Orders 100. He's forced to rewrite them by General Halleck because they don't allow for enough authority for the military to detain and charge women partisans. So if they didn't matter, why is that there? Why does Halleck literally edit Lieber's code on the margins? Because the war isn't just what's going on at Gettysburg, it's what happens when they move on from those battles and they have to hold a place. The Union has to hold it, or the Confederacy has to hold it. So, you know, I mean, this is a war. It's a military conflict. I think we have to think about mobilization. We have to think about the nature of the war, which isn't simply a formal conflict between armed and named bodies. And I think we also have to think about what Lee said when he surrendered, which was, what is it? We were outdone, outmatched in men and arms. Mm-hmm. Okay, why? Why were you, if that's the answer to military defeat, then I think I have better answers to that than the people who think about what happened on the third day of any given battle. So I would say I'm just following up Lee's observation.
One final question for you. And it deals with social media, which is something that I'm absolutely fascinated with, historians on social media and how they engage with the public. These days, especially with all the monuments coming down, the Confederate monuments coming down in great numbers now, there are neo-Confederates and Confederate apologists. I don't know if we can distinguish those two or not, but just to be nice, I like to say Confederate apologists from time to time, that are kind of regurgitating a lot of the Confederate mythology that's once again, when I published my book in 2014, I talked about this mythology as it was sort of receding, and now I think it's resurging. It's in our faces quite a lot these days, and it's because the monuments are coming down in great numbers. But they're bringing things back up again, like the slavery being incidental to the war, the overwhelming support for state rights ideology, or the overwhelming support in the White South for Confederate nationalism, and these things that I think are mythological. Now, you from time to time, and I follow you on Twitter, you from time to time engage with some of these folks, and sometimes it can get kind of nasty, and sometimes it can get kind of heated. My question, and you know, I used to talk to these guys too, and honestly, I got frustrated, and it became too much for me to deal with. But you just go for it. And I'm wondering, is there a value to engaging with? You're not going to convince these guys of anything. I mean, they've got their agenda, and they're going to that's the hill they're going to die on. What's the value really in speaking with these folks online, who really come after you hard, by the way? Especially, and this is another way that this book is coming back to the surface a lot these days, is that people are you know, coming after you for it, for some of the arguments that you make in it.
Yeah. I mean, it's a great question. And you might even be thinking about a recent go around I had with some of these extremely young, I think, white guys.
Yeah. Always young white guys, yeah.
Whether the Confederate Constitution really, what was it about? Whether the Confederate Constitution really said that you couldn't emancipate slaves.
Right.
And it was just so disingenuous, the whole thing. I mean, I'm on Twitter for a lot of reasons. One of them is I follow all, I have my Irish Twitter, I have my literary Twitter, I have my BLM Twitter. I mean, it's like I'm on Twitter for a lot of reasons. You know, being a historian on Twitter is sometimes the relevant thing because of the conversations that evolve. that particular conversation was extremely nasty. And I don't normally engage that directly, but I really got my back up about the misogyny of it. Mm-hmm. And there's so much of this that women face in American political life and in the academy mm-hmm. that I knew I should back down, but I also knew that they wanted me to back down. And then I got stuck. My son was, "Mom, just stop." And they, I feel like I got a bit worried because I feel like I'm being followed onto other forums that are more scholarly and academic. And I can see in the chat when they're open, now that this is the age of Zoom, which is another problem. Zoom, people widely advertise events and anybody can sign in. And then I see on the chat that there are these same exact actors and voices harassing me as I'm participating in a forum, even in my own department mm-hmm. event, but it was widely available. Anybody could join. So that's a little worrying. You know, I don't like that. And it's not so, but the more important question you're asking about why, what's the value of engaging? There's probably very little value of engaging with them, but I think that the fact that somebody like me would talk in terms of actual historical information about the Confederacy at moments when it seems relevant to events that are unfolding now, I think that's of value. So for example, it was really a Twitter conversation that made me, I answer a tweet right a couple of months ago saying something like, well, does anybody think, we don't think enough about what the Confederacy really was, because the Confederacy becomes this mythic thing that happened afterwards. And that was part of why I was thinking, well, does anybody really know what the Confederacy was when it existed? So that was back to my book, which I hadn't been thinking about or talking about in public for 8 years. Mm-hmm. And then Yoni Applebaum at the Atlantic one said, well, what, you know, he followed up and I wrote an article for the Atlantic, which got a lot of, which was just kind of useful. It's like 1,000 words on what the Confederate Constitution said and what the Confederacy was, the kind of thing we've been talking about today. Mm-hmm. So I think that has value because, you know, not everybody's going to read 12 history books to get a grip on. I think we have a role to play, I guess, is what I'm saying in this particular moment. I mean, the burden, I don't think it's just about Confederate monuments coming down. I think it's about Black Lives Matter.
Yeah.
And it's about backlash. I mean, this is Obama backlash on steroids. That's why in 2014 you weren't getting it. After 2016, it just, and then after Charlottesville, it's just on steroids. And so this feels like 1873 to me, like the torches are lit, you know, and young white men are armed. They're in collusion with police forces. I think we should be talking about Reconstruction, not the Confederacy, but the people who want to make that defense, that white supremacist position, somehow they can't surrender the Confederacy. They have to redeem that. That's interesting. We need to think about that. Why are they constantly redeeming the Confederacy as a place to stand to launch their, you know, they want to deny that the Confederacy was a white supremacist project so that they can deny that what they're doing now is a white supremacist project. So I feel like if I'm not going to say on social media or in short journalistic articles, well, no, the Confederacy was a white supremacist project. This is exactly what they said. Okay, by 1870, Jefferson Davis was singing a different tune. But that was a different moment in 1861. This is what they were saying. Yeah. So, I mean, I'm equipped to do that. And I feel I feel a responsibility to do that. It's a very tiny piece. It's a very tiny contribution. What can I really do? I'm a professor. I'm a writer. I'm a citizen. And I just feel like if I don't use whatever small platform I have to do that, then I'm not doing what I can in this particular moment. I have no illusions about how significant it is, but it does help us hold together, I think, and identify with one another in this moment when we need to, because it's so frightening. And also, to the extent that it has any meaning at all, I want to signal my allyship. That's all I can do.
Well, I think that that's a perfect place to leave off then. Stephanie, it's been a fascinating conversation with you today. Your book is Confederate Reckoning, Power and Politics in the Civil War South. And you have a book since then that I would, you know, it's on the top of my reading list. And I'm going to get to that very soon. The Women's War, Fighting and Surviving American Civil War. And that's from Harvard University Press, published last year, 2019. So we need to get that too. And then have you back on and talk about that one. You are on Twitter. Yes. Your handle is?
S. McCurry 6, I believe.
S. McCurry 6. Well, I will link it.
I have a website, so people can just go to stephaniemccurry.com and they'll find the Twitter and various pieces posted.
stephaniemccurry.com. Go there, check her out, see what she's up to, and engage, because she will. There you got it. Thanks a lot, Stephanie, for being on the show. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Kate.
So let me take a sec to tell you all about an exciting project I've got going on at Keith Harris History. I've transcribed and podcasted a series of letters written by Confederate prisoner of war Henry A. Allen. Allen was an officer in the 9th Virginia Infantry who was captured at Gettysburg at the Bloody Angle, the culmination of the Pickett-Pettigrew assault on July 3, 1863. He served in various prisoner of war camps for the duration of the war. During this time, he wrote often to his wife Sarah, back in Portsmouth, Virginia, discussing the day-to-day life in Union prisons and his many thoughts on the war, his marriage and children, and life as a prisoner. I am currently annotating these letters to fill in the missing information and provide links to useful resources concerning Allen in particular and the prisoner of war experience in general. This is an ongoing process where I'll be adding new information and revising my commentary as my research on the topic develops. So please go to keithharrishistory.com, click on the podcast tab, and have a listen to the Civil War letters of Henry A. Allen. From there, you can explore all kinds of resources and book suggestions that will help enrich your understanding of Union prisons and Confederate prisoners.